Blog Talk Radio.
Now, have you ever considered being a squirrel?
It's bizarre.
Hello, and welcome to episode 7 of Bizarro UK with Adam Millard. We're going to be talking in a little while, in a moment, to Graham Reynolds, author of High Moor and High Moor 2, just after this little intro. From that introduction, Graham is an author of many things, but primarily werewolf fiction. He's got High Moor, a novel, and High Moor 2, Moonstruck, and I believe working on High Moor 3 at the moment.
Yeah, it's fair to say that I'm a little bit behind on High Moor 3. It's called Blood Moon, and it's tying up the trilogy, bringing everything sort of full circle, tying up all the loose ends, and damn, it's finishing off a trilogy harder than it looks. There's an awful lot of plot threads and things like that that need to be considered. So yeah, I'm a little bit behind with that, but that will be out this year. I'm hoping sort of around May. I'm going to try and get that out.
Excellent. So how did you get into writing in general? Just tell us a bit about
it. It was one of those things, and I think a lot of people say this, is, oh, it's something that I really wanted to do, and it was something that I was good at school. I used to write a lot of stories and things like that. I was quite good at English Lit, and I used to do a lot of sort of role-playing games, and like D&D and things like that, where I'd write quite intricate plots and do a lot of world-building. So, I was just told, why don't you just spend a little bit less time playing video games, and I was heavily into World of Warcraft at the time, and see if you can do a bit of writing. So I did a couple of little stories.
Yeah.
And just sent them off to some electronic e-zines at the time. I think the first places that published me was an e-zine called Flashes in the Dark, which I was incredibly grateful for, because all of a sudden they said, yeah, we love your story. And they published it, and I just couldn't believe it. I was over the moon. It was just like, wow, there's this place, and I didn't get paid for it, but they've still sort of said, we like your story enough to actually publish this.
Yeah. It's a nice feeling, isn't it?
It is. That first time is just, it's like nothing else.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's just like, wow, actually, this isn't shit. Or if it, you have to look back with the early ones.
It's all fucking downhill from there.
it gave me the encouragement to actually go through and carry on with it. And yeah, I mean, I did a lot of flash fiction. I did a few longer pieces and went through the stages that we all go through, where we go and start putting stuff into these anthologies that don't offer author copies, and then we realise after a couple of them that, you know what, actually the only audience, the only market for these anthologies is the authors and their mums.
And then we start
aiming a bit higher, and we start going for a few semi-pro publications, the odd prorate one.
But I think if you don't get jacked over a few times for those first few books, you haven't really started right. You've got to really start with a non-payer, work your way up to a contributor copy, and then go, fucking hell, I can't believe I didn't get paid for that last story, and then work your way up to semi-pro, like you said, and then... That's the way. I don't think there's any other way.
I started writing the novel. I tried jumping straight into the novel. And I did the first chapter, and it was god-awful. It was so bad. I dug it out again a few months ago and looked at that first ever crack at the first chapter of High Miller. And it's just like, oh, God.
Yeah, I do that when I read back some of my stuff. I went to rewrite a rewrite of my first book, and I got about 10 pages in. I was like, it ain't fucking worth it. It's just not worth it, is it?
So you look at it and you just go mad trying to rewrite all these old stories. I just try not to draw attention to them now. It's just like, yeah, we don't worry about my old stuff.
Leave it.
Was all right. Some of that I don't mind, but there's a few others that I'm sort of quite glad that have been consigned to the history books, as it were.
Yeah. But the thing is, I mean, even with the shit stuff, you still wouldn't send it to a fucking non-paying publisher. It's like, I'd rather set fire to it and do a shit on it.
Not anymore, but then at the same time, at the time, this was all sort of stuff that gave me confidence and sort of started teaching me about the business.
No, I started exactly the same way, to be fair. I mean, there were publishers that, I didn't get anything out of it, but I think, you have to start. You learn.
E-zines, Place Life Flash in the Dark, Micro Horror, and stuff like that. I find them, they're all right. Even now, if I go through there and I have an old flash fiction story in that, Flashes in the Dark especially, they give me my start, so I'd be more than happy to give them something for free, because it's something that they do for the love.
Yeah.
And it's not something where they're going through there and saying, right, okay, well, we're going to go and put this anthology out, and we're not going to pay you. We're not going to give you any contributors' copies, and we're just going to trouser all the cash.
Yeah.
And that's a different story. Places where somebody's doing it for the love, and they've got an audience, and there's people read it every week, and there's people enjoy it, then I think it's worthwhile putting them the odd short story. I'm not too precious about that. When somebody's getting paid for it, no, I'm not, though. It's like, oh, hang on a second.
What's your writing process like? How do you plan, or do you just go straight in, do you like to outline every chapter, or do people do it? They actually just write whole outlines for each chapter.
I did that once, and every three chapters I had to change it because the characters that keep doing something that was completely unexpected, and it just threw me for a complete cuz. Oh fuck, I've just gone through that and my entire chapter plan is just knackered now.
Yeah.
Shit, right, okay, I'll start again. What I do now is I use a program called WireWriter, which I'm finding dead handy. It's sort of it's free, but I find it so useful that I sort of paid them the shareware fee for it, which is only like 20 quid or something. And I'll start off now with, I know roughly where I'm going to be, and because I'm working with a trilogy and a series in some respects, it's easier because it's cause and effect.
Yeah.
The characters are already doing things, and then it's just a case of, right, he's done that, what's going to happen as a result of it? But at the same time, I look at it in terms of the pacing as well. So my initial outline is going to, it'll start off with just a couple of lines, not even for every chapter, I start off, for example, with High Miller 1. I started off, and the werewolf turned up every five chapters, I think, in the first book. And then as it started getting closer towards the end, the werewolf turned up more often. It was then, it would turn up, every three, the five, four, three, two, then you've got just got the werewolf, you know, just to sort of work on the pace.
Yeah.
So I tend to sort of, I don't tend to outline much more than that to start with. I'll go through there, and very often it'll be start off with this. I'll maybe have a key plot point as one chapter as the main thing that's going to happen in that. Others might just say action chapter to start with. And then as I go, at least I've got a framework and I've got something to aim towards. I mean, it still goes out the window every once in a while.
Yeah,
but I think the worst thing you can do is to turn around there and try to force the story into a mould. The story is going to be what the story wants to be. And quite often, just where you have problems and what I've found I've been blocked in the past is I've been trying to force the damn thing to go the way that I wanted to, and the characters and the story go, nah, fuck off, mate, we're off this way. It's a lot easier when you just back off and let them get on with it.
Yeah, I think that's always a good sign when your characters are doing things independent of your plot, then you know that it's going to catch the audience off as well, so it's a good thing. I think Joe Lansdale said a couple of weeks back about editing, how he pretty much just does a draft. He polishes it as he goes, and then it's really done by the time he finishes. What's your editing like? I mean, do you sort of self-edit as you go?
I self-edit to a point. I mean, I go through, I mean, I do it with Horrific Tales, for example. The books that we put out, we go through a 7-stage editorial process.
Yeah.
And there's still fucking mistakes to get through that we have to fix afterwards. But when I'm doing it for my own stuff, I always start off. So when I sit down for the day to start me writing, I will read the chapter beforehand.
Yeah.
Because that not only gets me back into the story, it gets me back at the scene, it reminds me what's going on. But it also means that if there's anything blatant, I can just sort of tweak it as I'm going, as I'm doing that.
Yeah.
So by the time I get to my first draft, it's actually relatively clean. And then I'll get, like, I've got like 2 beta readers that I use, and they'll come back and let me know if there's anything where I've just really got it wrong, or if there's a bit that doesn't make sense, or if there's a bit that's boring.
Yeah.
I'll go through and I'll clean it up after that. And then I go through it, so I use a text-to-speech app, and I'll read it back while listening to Stephen Hawkins narrating it to me. That's really handy, because that is very good at picking up wrong word typos that something like, you know, the spell check on Word isn't going to spot. And you get word blind, so actually having it come into you in a different medium is really, really useful. And then at that point, you know, once I actually get to that stage, that's when it's ready to go. Then go to an editor. And I use 2. I use Simon Marshall-Jones, who runs Spectral Press, and I use Lisa Jenkins, and they both do work on all of the Horrific Tales books as well.
Both great editors.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Lisa just recently did, I think it was Stuck on You for Jasper Bark. You know, I'm like,
that's a funny book.
Oh, yeah.
I like Jasper.
Yeah, I met Jasper for the first time at FantasyCon this year, and he's hilarious.
He doesn't even know how hilarious he is, but he just is. He's one of the nicest guys. I'm not going to suck his dick live on air, but
no, you're with me.
I couldn't wait till I see him next. We're going to talk about werewolves, because I mean, obviously, you write about werewolves a lot, and Stephen Hawkins reads them back to you as well.
Here comes you have no clue how fucking sick I am of werewolves. I can't wait to get this trilogy finished so I can write something else. If I have to do one more transformation scene, I'm going to kill myself.
So I was going to ask you about, was it like, what is it so much that you enjoy about werewolves? Obviously you don't, so we can move on.
I really do, but you know, at the moment, in my entire writing career, because I'm not the fastest writer in the world, and I will end up sort of, you know, bunking off for months at a time, which is, you know, I've got people pissed off at me because they're like, where's this next book coming out? And it's like, I'll sort it. Honestly, I'll get through it. But no, I mean, the thing about the High Moor books was that it was based on something from a kid, and there was just this one, it started off with this one scene.
Yeah.
And the story was that I'd basically been at Cub Scout camp. I must have been about 9 years old or something. And there was a whole bunch of us sat around the campfire, and this kid had basically turned around and said, "Oh yeah, I've just been reading a book about this, you know, called Wolven by Whitley Strieber." I mean, if you've read Wolven by Whitley Strieber, I mean, it's a masterpiece. It's a fantastic book, terrifying, but it's got nothing to do with kids around in a Cub Scout camp. This kid had seen like the cover of it, and then just basically used it to shit me up, and basically said, "Oh yeah, this werewolf comes in through a Boy Scout camp," and like it. That scared me so much as like an 8 or 9 year old that I then got up in the middle of the night and walked 10 miles through Country Lane's home. And you know, years later I read the book and realised that he's just an evil little bastard who's been winding me up. But you know what, if that kid hadn't said that to me, High Moor probably wouldn't have existed. Because there was this, and you know, that scene happened. That was basically the point of the book, or at least that's how it started from. I had this real vivid image. I mean, you know, it's set in the UK. We don't have guns over here.
Not legally.
Not legally, yeah. I mean, you know, but they're not widespread and things like that. It's not like, you know, everybody in their, you know, and their babysitters packing AK-47s or whatever. We don't have it over here, and that basically means that, you know, supernatural creatures and things like werewolves, where you need the silver bullet or whatever, it's going to be a much more difficult proposition. And then you sort of put a bunch of sort of 8 to 12 year olds in the forest in tents and stuff like that, and have one tear through it, and there's not going to be a hell of a lot you can do about it. It's going to be a bloodbath, it's going to be a slaughter, and it's going to be terrifying. So yeah. A lot of the book then grew up out of putting a story around that scene. And that happens, you know, that fairly early on, that scene. That basically is how the first part of the book ends. You know, the novel split into three parts.
Yeah.
Because after that, it was a case of, well, what happens next? And so then it sort of focuses in on one of the main child characters who's actually been scratched by this werewolf during this, like, brutal attack. And, like, and how he actually then deals with the fact that he's, like, a 9-year-old boy who's going to change into a werewolf. And, like, his parents don't believe him and say, "Oh, don't be so bloody stupid." Yeah.
Stick around, you'll fucking find out.
yeah, blatantly.
I think having kids against werewolves was a stroke of genius, really, because, I mean, you know, it's that whole innocence and you know, they aren't, you know, adept at fighting, and, you know, they have to find other ways to defeat the beast. I mean, that's pretty smart.
Yeah, and as I say, you know, I really love it. And the other thing, I mean, everybody says, I mean, I don't know if this is true with you, but people keep saying that your first novel's always got a fair chunk of your own life in there. It's almost autobiographical. And that was very, very true with High Moor 1. I mean, some of the stuff that the kids get up to, there's a scene with them where they're sort of in class with a school video recorder, and you've got the geography teacher trying to sort of play the... plays some sort of crappy VHS cassette like agriculture and crop rotation in the 17th century. And like one of the kids he's noticed the video recorders, the same ones they've got at home, so he's brought the remote control in there. And every time the teacher presses play, it's sort of rewinds up to the back and stuff like that. And
was that you at school? Like, there was always one at our school that did that.
Well, that was me. And that's pretty much as written.
That's all right, though, because, I mean, there's only so many times you can actually watch Gandhi.
Oh, blatantly.
You know what I mean? It's like, once you've seen Gandhi, you know how it ends. It's pretty much fucking done and dusted. We got a question from the beautifully homoerotic Rich Hawkins. He says, do you find it difficult being both a publisher and a writer?
I do, from the perspective, not so much as sort of keeping quality control, because I basically put my own books through the same process, you know, so I essentially pass the pointy stick off to Lisa and Simon and the beta readers, and they kick my ass the same way as they kick everybody else's. the most difficult part is actually finding the time. I find that the publishing can be very, very time-consuming.
Yeah.
And it can take up an awful lot of mental energy, and that's partly the reason why it's taken me so long to get this third book out.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I love both sides of it. It's difficult. I couldn't choose between one or the other because I love being a publisher. I mean, I got such a kick out of it because when the first two, my first two novels, Chimera and Moonstruck, were doing so well. They were being, far exceeded my expectations of how well they were going to do.
Yeah.
And so I decided, well, you know what, maybe I can try and apply this to something else. So I didn't take any money out of the business, as it were. It's all just sat in there from day one, pretty much. And then I approached Michael Bray. And I'd sort of read a version of his book, Whisper, when he'd self-published it. And again, this was through the HWA when I was still a member of that. And he was still a member. And I went, actually, you know, I really like this book. Is, you know, if you decide that you want to actually go with somebody and publish it, let me know. And so he went, oh, no, I'd love to. So I paid him a chunk of money as an advance and then went off and went and sort of brutalized his novel, really. I think I cut about 5 or 6 chapters worth of text out of it just to sort of sort the flow out and things like that. And we put that out there. And, I mean, you know, the damn thing does better than mine.
It's fine, that.
You know, it's going to be incredibly successful. And I look at the other books that we've put out since. And, yeah, I'm proud because we do the best that we can with each of them. So I don't think I'll be giving up that anytime soon. But, yeah, it is nice just to be able to create and just, you know, come up with new and increasingly amusing ways to slaughter people. I love that as well. So I don't think I'll be stopping that either.
No, that's it. I mean, the whole thing's a lot of fun if you allow it to be. Horrific Tales Publishing, not to be confused with a non-paying ship press of a similar name. What's in store for 2015?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. There was a point I considered changing the name of the press so that we wouldn't get confused with them.
Yeah.
And I have actually managed to upset them because, quite famously, when I do my launch parties, I get rat assed because I can be quite a funny drunk, especially when I'm on one. So I do my launch parties pissed. I'll just be there with a bottle of wine. It's just like, right, get it down my neck. And then I'll just post, you know, doing caption compositions of like increasingly borderline images. I mean, on the Angel Manor one, I think. Finishing up with, you know, caption this picture, and it was a nun from a porno movie with having somebody coming all over her face or something like that. And there was nothing, you know, it was just like somebody, this nun with a mouth open and white stuff over it. And it's just like, no! But it was one of the other launches.
Just a nun having a nice drink of milk.
It could have been something quite innocent. But yeah, one of the other launches, somebody got the two presses mixed up and said that.
Yeah.
And I'm at the launch from da-da-da, and I went, no, they tagged him in Facebook, and I went, no, there's a big difference. We pay our authors.
Yeah.
And I came up there, and he was getting, his feathers were quite ruffled, I think it was fair to say.
Yeah, it's a bit of a, I know that you had a tough time with the whole, do I change the name, do I keep it? And decided on, fuck it, keep it. People don't know the difference.
I've been going longer than they have, so fuck them, frankly.
And you'll be around a lot longer as well.
I hope so. You know, if it doesn't kill me.
So, yeah, what you got in store for 2015 anyway? Anything scheduled? Or?
It's great, actually, because we're in a position where I've actually got the manuscripts for pretty much every book that we're bringing out, apart from my own. I still haven't finished Chimera 3 yet. But the next one out the door is one from Benjamin Cain Etheridge called Bottled Abyss. Now, this is one that was previously released, and it actually got nominated for a Bram Stoker Award. My feelings on that award are sort of, you know, not even mixed. I think, you know, I don't have a great deal of time for the organisation or the award personally, but you know, it got nominated, it did well, it was very popular, and then the publisher sort of decided that it was through, decided they were going to wind up, and so Ben approached me and said, would you be interested in taking it on? So we've given it a new cover, and we're going to, I've done a bit of a structural edit, I've tweaked it, I've looked at the reviews that it had, good and bad, and then gone through and have a look at it, and sort of just seen where we could tighten stuff and refine stuff.
Yeah.
And that's all. I'll be getting the manuscript back. We've signed off on the cover now. Ben Baldwin has just done a fantastic job on the cover. It's absolutely astonishing. But then I fall in love with all the covers that we've got. I love them all.
Yeah.
And then I should be getting the manuscript back from Ben back end of this week, and then it's off to the editor. I've got two books from William Holloway. We published his novel Lucky's Girl back end of last year. Which is, it's been probably one of our most controversial ones to date, just because of the subject matter. I mean, I think it's brilliant. It's a sort of a real callback to the old Graham Masterton type of horror. It's proper old school, and it's grim, and it really doesn't pull any punches.
There's not enough of that about at the moment.
You what, sorry?
There's not enough of that about at the moment, the old school stuff. I think there's still a place for it.
Yeah, definitely. But we're starting, reissuing, he's basically doing two concurrent Lovecraftian trilogies. The first part of the first one, he self-published a while ago, and I've taken that on. We're going to be putting that through the editorial process, called The Immortal Body. It's kind of like True Detective, but with it's a lot more visceral.
Yeah.
If you like. So the idea of it starts off with a faith healer in a church. And this faith healer, when he touches people, he puts demons in them. And it starts off with this horrific slaughter in this church, you know. So he lays hands on this crippled girl, and she gets to her feet and basically rips the vicar's throat out and then runs out and throws herself under a truck and stuff. But then you've got somebody who's a spirit medium who actually raises the dead and brings zombies out. And there's somebody orchestrating this behind the scenes, the necromancer.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a fantastic book. I mean, that's going to have to be, you know, we'll be tightening that up. We'll be completely reissuing it. But then he's essentially got another trilogy, and I've got the first part of that, where you look at the bad guy from The Immortal Body, and this necromancer called Lich. And then it's called Song of the Death God, and it's an origin story. It's almost gothic.
Yeah.
But so it's sort of set back in the 1800s in Germany, and sort of shows the genesis of this monster, you know, from a child. And then then the Immortal Body series is going to carry on. He's almost finished the second book, and that's pretty much a real time present day sort of thing. And then the Song of the Death God series is going to be the second book in that series is going to be set in the First World War. So you're going to sort of like Cthulhu in the First World War sort of thing. It's not Cthulhu, but it's that sort of cosmic horror.
Yeah.
Along those lines. And then like the third one in the Song of the Death God series is going to be in set in the Second World War.
Nice.
Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to that as well. Beyond that, as I said, there's High Moor 3, once I finish it. we should hopefully, towards the back end of the year, have the second part of the Chantal Nordlouche's Angel Manor series. And fingers crossed for that one.
Excellent. So you've got plenty on the go then.
I'm already looking at stuff for 2016. I don't want to do too many in a year. At the moment, I'm putting six a year out, maybe seven, because that way I can go through there. We're not getting overloaded. We can make sure that everything's as good as it can be, and we can market it properly, and it's working so far, that model. You look at some places and certain presses that you and I both know the name of, that was, I think they put like 200 books or something out last year, and every single one of them pretty much sank without a trace, purely and simply because I think they were saturating their own reader base.
Yeah. I think everybody knows who that is without even sort of getting ourselves in it.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say. That was going to stay there. my next thing. I mean, you're not afraid to speak your mind via your blog, which is awesome. I mean,
yeah, I think the word gobshite.
No. I mean, I know a lot of people. I mean, I always read it, and when giving them sense to the whole situation with the permuted press shenanigans, I said it,
yeah.
And Amazon's apparent war against proper punctuation.
Oh my god, I wanted to crawl into a little hole and die with that.
Yeah, I have no idea how that ended. Was it hyphen gate? It was.
Oh my god.
Yeah, I mean, Amazon's pretty much trying to rewrite the rules on punctuation.
The thing is with Amazon, I mean, I've seen documentaries on them, and if they have a single complaint about a product, that product is put under investigation.
Yeah.
That's the way that the organisation works. And in theory, that's actually quite a good way of doing things. But, yeah, when they turned around there and pulled Moonstruck because somebody complained there was hyphenated, I mean, the Americans don't use hyphens as much as we do in the UK.
Mm.
But it was... You know, and I thought, oh, you know, it's just one of these stupid things. I just wrote back to them and went, look, you know, here's a copy and pasted bit and from the Oxford English Dictionary, and it shows the correct usage, and I think you'll find this is a perfectly valid way to do things.
Yeah.
And I just got sort of a robot message back going, please remove hyphenated words. And it's like, what? So, you know, as I tend to do, I just went and had a bit of a whinge about it on my blog, and they were like, what the fuck? Really?
Yeah.
What I didn't expect was for that blog to get nearly 500,000 hits and end up getting picked up. I mean, God, I had Canadian bloody news stations contacting me for radio interviews. There were articles in the Mail and the Guardian and the Times, and it's just like, what? What the hell?
It needed to be brought to the attention of the people who write, because this could happen to anybody. I mean, I use hyphens a lot. It's like every other word I throw one in. Fucking. But, yeah, I mean, how... This is the thing. If they're going to police something like that, then they're going to have to go through everything they've ever published. And
Well, the thing is, it wasn't even the fact that they actually had an issue with hyphens as such.
No.
It was the fact that somebody had complained about it.
One complaint, yeah.
And, I mean, there was a worse situation... And it was, I'll try to remember her name, but there was a girl 3 or 4 weeks ago. And I think she's very popular. Her book's incredibly popular. She's basically, sort of top 1,000 on Kindle overall, this book. It's been really, really successful. I mean, you know what it's like with the ranks and the numbers she's got to have been selling for that. And somebody complained about the subject matter. And, I mean, this is a book about human trafficking.
Yeah.
And two people who were being human trafficked and the relationship that they formed between them and the struggles that they had to go to escape the situation. And somebody complained about it and said that it was disturbing subject matter, and Amazon pulled that.
Yeah. I mean, you pretty much...
Hang on a second, that's a step too far.
You know what you're getting into? If there's a book about human trafficking, there's going to be scenes of general, horror in there. And
yes.
You know, it's to be expected, but... To complain about it. I think we're living in a strange world at the moment where everything is offensive and...
Oh, no. Honestly, when I hear somebody say trigger warning, I just want to punch him in the face.
Yeah. Neil Gaiman, his next book, isn't it called Trigger Warning? Isn't it?
Yeah, I know. It's like, oh, I'm offended by that. It's like, oh, I couldn't give a fucking shit.
Exactly.
I mean, who do you? Never mind.
I mean... Back in the 80s and the 90s, and, you know, you had, like, Richard Layman, Sean Hudson. Today, fucking hell, those authors would be just constantly torn down from Amazon.
I know. I can't believe that Matt Shaw. be honest.
Matt Shaw is pretty extreme, yeah, and he's getting away with it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Sick Bastard starts off with a scene of incest and then progresses into cannibalism within the first chapter.
And it's all downhill from there.
But, yeah. It got to the point where I think I was sort of psychologically damaged and became a little bit immune to it by the end of the book. It's just like, oh, look, there's another incestuous orgy in amongst someone's entrails by the end of it. It was just like, you know, I'd ended up getting a 1,000-yard stare. I think with a post-traumatic stress disorder by the time I finished the book.
Exactly. exactly. do you think it's, well, obviously you do, I mean, it's important for as an author, as a public figure, to be able to speak your mind and not hide behind anything, just say what you think, or do you think there are limits?
Yeah, and to be fair, I do that. I've always done that. Mouth opens, words come out. It's generally relatively unvarnished. Tact and diplomacy are things that I can do. I just rarely see the point of. Because people very rarely accuse me of not understanding what I'm talking. Well, apart from the accent, obviously. But, you know, people are generally sort of, I don't tend to sit on the fence over things. If I feel something, if I have a feeling about something, if I say, you know, actually, this is crap. This is a load of bollocks. I will say that. I won't turn around there. Oh, well, that's not very good. Do you think the possibility is like, no, that's fucking shite and you're an idiot. But that's unfortunately the way that I am.
That's not a bad thing. I mean, it's an honourable trait to say what you think. It's the people who feel the need to hold back and then, you know, explode behind the scenes, I think, are the ones that you've got to watch.
Yeah, definitely all the ones that will sort of go through there and, you know, they won't say what the thing is, you say, and sort of go behind the scenes and will either explode or they'll nitpick and will undermine and sort of backstab, whereas, you know, I don't backstab people, you know, I'm weird the life in front of the face.
as a writer, I mean, your books have been nominated, Highmore was nominated, wasn't it, for a was it shortlisted or nominated for a Bram Stoker?
It was shortlisted.
Shortlisted. I mean,
at the point that Moonstruck was actually up there, and at the point that I turned around and pulled it, I withdrew it from the award. At the point that that happened, I think I was second in terms of recommendations behind Nosferatu by Joe Hill. But at the same time, it's just, there's a certain amount of crap that goes with those awards that I'm no longer prepared to be a part of.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's always divided opinion, isn't it? I mean, for those nominated, it's great, and for those who aren't nominated, it's shit. And then further down the line, those were nominated, think it's shit, and then it's all.
The thing is, like, it has no effect at all on sales, none. If anything, it's actually a negative thing, because you'll get all of the sycophants and the arseholes of the people, you know, who think, oh, my friend's book should have made that. And you end up getting the backbiting, and you get the negative attention, and you end up getting a rash of bad reviews.
Well, that's
motivated behind it, and it makes not a damn bit of difference to sales. And then you actually have a look at the ones that's won it for the last few years. You know, the one that sort of won its first novel last year, and it's died on its arse commercially. It's sold hardly anything. You look at it, and it's sort of got a sales rank somewhere in the half a millions, and it's got like 20 or 30 reviews, and it's done nothing for it. I look at, Michael Bray's novel was in that same category that year, and it was long-listed and didn't make it actually to the nominations. And that book's got 261 reviews. It's sold something like 6,000 copies. You know what? I know which one I'd rather have.
Yeah, great. Yeah, it's a tough one. Awards season's always the same. It comes round. The backbiting starts. People start, you know, and then you get the ones defending it, and you can't say bad shit about anything, and you can't, because you're taking it away from the author. So it's, you best just sort of staying out of it. That's the way I do it.
Keeping the hell out of it. I've disqualified my own stuff on a permanent basis from being considered for that award. If I see anything of mine ever on that list, I will contact them and I will say, get it off. You know, it's not up there. I can't be dealing with the drama that goes with it. Yeah. And it's pointless. It's nothing to do with the quality of the book. Sometimes it is, but usually it's to do with who the cool kids in the Horror Writers Association are at the moment. Who's got the most friends? You know, it's called the Strokers for a reason. Ooh. And it's this gripping.
You can't call it that. You can't call it that.
Fucking back.
That word, that's a trigger warning that should come with. That's terrible. You had the R. Oh, that's it.
You know, the HWA has got some wonderful people in there. It's got some incredibly knowledgeable, generous, sensible, funny, talented people in there, and it's got some fucking arseholes in there as well. And you know what? Unfortunately, the arseholes are usually louder.
It's always the way. So I was going to ask what, if anything, pisses you off since so far you've been a ray of sunshine.
I haven't I? No, but it's, you know what, it's like, I honestly, believe it or not, I'm actually relatively easygoing a lot of the time. I just get really fucked off when people start trying to mess with my life. Or mess with my friend's life, and that will be extended to the people that I publish and my authors. Yeah. So I get quite defensive, and I will, you know, I don't, you know, I suppose attacking stuff head on and sort of going, right, okay, come on then. It's not the default situation. I do try to calm things down. I will try to sort of come to an amicable solution, but there comes a point where it's just like, you know what. I'm just going to have to get Geordie at this point. There's nothing else for it. Sadly, that's the thing that usually works as well. So that just reinforces the behaviour. I'm just going to get worse and worse as I get older.
I'm looking forward to it, though. I mean, I'm at that age now where it's sort of like, you know what, my days are giving a shit behind me. I can start pissing myself in public soon and... I'm 35 now. If I want to shit on the bus, I'll shit on the bus.
Yeah, I mean, I'm 43, so you can imagine how much less of a fuck I give at this point.
Do you have any...
I don't like people who are ingenuous. I don't like people who cause trouble and kick off and generate drama for their own, just to make themselves feel better.
Yeah.
It's just tiresome. I would just rather, like, you know, I've said to a few of my mates recently, it's like, oh, wouldn't it be so nice just to have a boring bloody few days? You know, let's have a week where nothing happens and nothing kicks off. That'd be nice.
Yeah. It doesn't happen. There's always something. I think with social media as well, that's the thing right there. It's like, everybody's within touching distance, but so far away. It's like,
Yeah. It'd be a very different situation if you could reach through the screen and twat somebody and turn around there and sort of flap them out a little bit too much. But you've got the same problem with social media as you used to have with email. Start with email, is that when something's written, it's so easy to be taken out of context and people will just get het up over it and just get really, really quite upset.
Yeah, well, that's
or it's just like, oh, why did you say that to me? And it's just like, I had this, there was some stuff kicked off earlier this week. And I may have told somebody to shut their stupid flapping fucking mouth. Because I was, you know, I'd lost my last nerve. It's just like, right, okay. And then somebody else messaged me, well, why are you saying that to me? And it's just like, no, I wasn't actually. I was saying that the twat that commented after you. Yeah. Oh, okay, that's fine then.
It's easy to get confused and people, you can't sort of send your tone along with the message. Like, oh, no, shut your fat fucking mouth. It was a joke. It doesn't quite transfer.
This is why emoticons were used, you know. It's just like, I would have put a smiley face on that, you know, that I'm not actually calling you a twat.
That comment would have been so much different if there was a shark's face at the end of it. Speaking of writing and publishing and authors, would you have any advice for any potential... authors for maybe future horrific tales, open submission periods, any sort of tips?
If you're going to submit a book to a publisher, you only generally get one shot at it, and I'm not, you know, so nobody's expecting it to be a finished, polished product, but some of the stuff that I've had on previous open submissions things, I mean, there was one guy who didn't believe in paragraphs.
Well, and, what are they? Did he work for Amazon?
Oh, honestly. So, I mean, like, I was asked for the first three chapters, and I got the first three chapters, and it was just like, it was a solid block of text.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, my eyes wanted to fall out, but no, okay. So, you need to have a good opening hook. That the first line needs to grab the reader's attention. If it doesn't, and your first page especially, usually you can tell if a book's going to be any good by the first page. If nothing's happened in the first page, if there's been no questions raised, if there's not even a hint of conflict, you know, I've read ones where people started off there and the first page is this guy sort of sitting on the step, you know, having a beer and looking at the sun going down, where... Or I think there was another one. There was a submission that I had where, again, it was a guy sort of getting out of bed in the morning, and then the next scene was somebody getting ripped apart by a shark. It's just like, start with a shark.
Always start with a fucking shark.
It doesn't have to be good or good, but something needs to happen. You need to raise a question.
Yeah.
You need to think, why is he doing that? Why is that happening? You've got to generate the interest to make the reader continue.
Yeah.
Otherwise, yeah, you just get bored. And I've got to be honest, I asked for the first three chapters, but generally by the time I finish the first page, I've made my mind up. If I'm bored by the end of the first page, I will carry on, because sometimes it's just an editing thing, and you can turn around and say, right, I'm just going to get rid of that. But, yeah.
Start with a shark.
yeah, definitely.
Go from there.
It's just one of those things where you've got to go through and do the best you can. And you know what? Don't try to write for the genre, like a niche or something like that. Write something that you love and write the book that you would want to read.
Yeah. Always a good book.
And that was very much what I did with the High Moor ones. I couldn't find the sort of werewolf horror that I wanted to read, so I just went off and wrote my own.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, other than, like, your books and, I don't know, Gary Brantner, the Howling series, and, you know, a few others, I mean, werewolves aren't as prevalent as zombies, let's say, because everybody's fucking writing zombies. So I suppose writing the werewolves for you was, you know, a nice... I don't know what I'm trying to say, yeah. But
it was a really good call, actually, because even now, I mean, it's been, over 3 years since the first book came out, and it's like it's the highest rated werewolf horror book on Amazon at the moment. I mean, yeah, you've got the paranormal romance ones, and they blow it out the wall.
I very rarely get
the top 20 in the werewolf, if you just in werewolves. Because the paranormal romance stuff's in there, but in terms of werewolf horror, I think I'm the highest rated one because there's just not that many.
Yeah. If you're fucking the werewolf, it's not a real werewolf. If you're, you know, having relations with a schoolboy, don't have relations with schoolboys. But what I'm saying is, if you're having relations with a college boy werewolf and it's, you know, a gang of them and they're all topless, that's not real. I was actually kept off the number one spot. Yeah, I'm gonna say it. Kept off the number one spot in comedy and humour in the category, which we all know that the categories on Amazon are neither here nor there anyway. But by a paranormal romance with a sparky vampire and a werewolf, and I was just pissed off that it was in the wrong category. It was like, these things are fucking everywhere. They're even in comedy and humour.
You've noticed that number one in UK horror on Amazon for years has been Stephen King's Bag of Bones, which is set in fucking Louisiana or something like that, set in the American Deep South.
Yeah.
Because they'll go through there and they'll just go and, you know, Stephen King's publishers go and deliberately miscategorise these things so that he's number one in most of the categories. Even though it's got fuck all to do with it.
Yeah. Well, that's the way it works. I mean, you know, fucking, Stephen King. Do you ever get writer's block? Is it something that you believe in, or is it just...
I do. And it always happens. It's the fear that sets in. I always get it before big action scenes and things like that. And when you start overthinking it.
Yeah.
And you start thinking, oh my God, you know, you've got this scene in your head and it's going to be big. It's a pivotal scene in the book. And I choke. I was like, ah, and I freak out and become convinced that whatever I could possibly write, and I try to examine every single possible permutation of how it can go, and I end up just sort of crawling a little ball and having to cry. And the only way to get through that, the only way to get through it, is just to take yourself out of the equation, get out of the goddamn way, and just write, because even if what you write is the worst thing that has ever been written by a human being, you can go back and you can do it again, and you can edit it, and you can fix it. You can't do a damn thing with a blank page.
Exactly.
And that's sometimes a very difficult message. Even when you know that, it can still be a very difficult thing to do. I mean, I see people saying, oh, writer's block's just laziness, and it's not. It's you get scared, and you become scared of writing. Honestly, for something that I love, there are days where I will do anything. I'll degrease the fucking oven, I will go through there, and I would sort of, you know, I will find the most menial, horrendous chore to do sometimes other than write. And actually, I enjoy writing, and yeah, I don't know what that is. But I think it's just because writing, it takes a lot out of you, mentally and emotionally.
It does. People, like, yeah, when you tell someone that you're a writer and they go, yeah, but what do you do for a living? No, this is it. But yeah, but what's your real job? No, this is... This takes it out of me as much as a real job would. I mean, it's fucking impossible sometimes, but then other times it's fantastic.
Honestly, it's the ones that really pissed me off is, oh, you know what, I'd like to write a book, I just don't seem to have the time. It's just like, yeah, all right. I work a 40-hour week in a day job, and I run a publishing company, and up until the start of this, well, middle of last year, I had a small holding with about 40 animals on it, and I've still been writing books, so fuck off, frankly.
Yeah, it's the worst excuse that is. I want to write a book, but half the time, the people who say I want to write a book and but I don't have the time shouldn't write a book. they shouldn't write the book. If that's your excuse,
it's the ones who then go for, oh, okay, I'll do that, and then they'll say, oh look, novel writing month, NaNoWriMo. I'll just do that, and then I'll just upload the first draft straight onto Kindle, and I'll be rich. And depressingly, some of them are still rich.
Yeah. I saw one not long ago. I think she was about 17 or something, and her NaNoWriMo thing got picked up by one of the big five, and it's like, fuck off!
Yeah, like, you bastard. You've sat down there and you've spent 4 weeks hammering something out, which is, I mean, you know, 50 Shades of Grey, Twilight, both of them fan fiction. And like both of them just rattled out, and you look at it from a writer's perspective and, you know, a craft perspective, and it's just like, you know what, if somebody submitted Twilight to me, you know, and you'd be the same if Twilight hadn't happened and somebody had sent you that, you'd have looked at what the fuck have you just sent me, and you'd have sacked it off. The fact is that both of those books hit a chord with a section of the market at the right time.
All about the right time, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
But I mean, it sparked a whole thing. Twilight did, didn't it? With the young adult and the Hunger Games and Divergent and
now. Yeah, yeah, and definitely. But I mean, if you look at this, really, Twilight is sort of it's a tamed down version of Buffy. You know, and that was where you sort of, you started having, like, the sort of the mortal with the monster. And you go back even further, you know, Anne Rice and stuff like that, the interview with the vampire and that. So there's always been an element of that. It's just that Twilight was the first time that they ever properly, you know, neutered the monster.
Yeah. Neutered.
Well, yeah, didn't
castrated.
They?
Chemically castrated.
We're just going to take you down the bed. Oh, I don't want to.
You'll be all nice and sparkly by the time we finish with you.
Morton the bloke there, he's got a little line of stitches around his bollocks. He's got to get a sad expression in his face.
Twinkly in the corner.
Yeah. With one of those cones of shame on there so he can't chew at it. Yeah. We're just going to take your nuts away now, Jacob. It'll be all right. Good boy, have a biscuit.
fucking! I'm never gonna watch Twilight again. I have watched it mainly because my wife watches any old shit. But yeah, I'm definitely not watching that. It's a fucking waste of my life. Speaking of which,
you're welcome to the mental.
We got a few minutes left. I want to talk about a couple of your what are your favourite werewolf films?
Real ones. Well, as I said, the best one's ever been made still American Werewolf in London. It's depressing when you think that it's been 30 odd years and nobody's actually managed to improve that in terms of special effects or story or plot or characterization or anything. It's still 30 years later and it's miles above everything else. After that, Dog Soldiers has to be.
Fucking hell, yes.
Yeah, I mean, Dog Soldiers is just. That had absolutely everything you could ever want in there. Then I suppose the first Howling movie, and then probably, I don't know, Ginger Snaps movies were really good. I actually liked all of those.
Not many people like the third one. I quite like all three.
Oh, that was the sort of the historical one. I loved that one. I thought that was great. It was a different take on things. It didn't really have a lot to do with the first ones, but even so, it was still an interesting take on them. Stephen King's Silver Bullet, based on Cycle of the Werewolf. It was great.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward. I want to see, there's one coming out called Late Phases, which is supposedly, it's been described to me as Silver Bullet with a blind war veteran instead of a kid.
I watched it about 2 weeks ago. It's really good. He's the protagonist is a blind man against a whole sort of pack of werewolves. It's really well done, quite tense. You imagine that, being blind and up against werewolves.
The word fuck springs to mind, really, doesn't it?
Well, you'd probably just lie down in a corner and just sort of wait, but he doesn't.
Well, yeah.
That wouldn't make much of a film, but
there was a weird one as well that I saw. It was called Were, W-E-R, and it was an attempt to do a realistic take on the werewolf myth. It was sort of set in France. And you know what? It was I really liked it, purely and simply because it sort of, they had this guy and it looked like it was just this bloke suffering from lycanthropy. And the first half of it, it's almost like a courtroom drama, you know, where you've got his lawyer trying to find stuff and digging into the past and things like that. And then it kicks off. And I mean, the transformation sequences are understated. You know, he doesn't turn to a proper wolf or anything like that. I think it was really quite well done. I was fairly impressed with that one. It's not going to be one of the all-time classics, but because, again, like the books, decent werewolf movies are few and far between.
I think there was one recently which was called Wolves, just Wolves, and I think
it's fucking awful.
Have you watched? I haven't watched it yet, but I know they were.
You know what? It was enjoyable enough to an extent, but it was just basically Lost Boys
with
a very, very pretty cast.
Yeah, somebody actually told me it was just Lost Boys, werewolves. I'm a big fan of Lost Boys, but
it's.
I want to see something different.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's nothing else to watch, and it's a choice of that or one of the Twilight movies put that on. Because at least there's blood and, you know, severed limbs and things like that in there, but it's still not great, let's be honest.
I might give it a go next time she wants to watch Twilight. Right, we're going to wind up.
Yeah.
How can people reach you? Have you got a website?
It's horrifictales.co.uk. I'm also on Facebook. You just need to follow the swearing and you'll usually find me. And I've also got an author site, which is grahamreynolds.com. It's the weird spelling of Graham, G-R-A-E-M-E.
Fantastic. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, mate.
Yeah. Looking forward to finally meeting you in the flesh
of a few conventions this year. We've got a few cons this year together. That'll be great. I haven't met you yet. I'm really looking forward to it. So, yeah, that's...
Your beat is to be sung.
It's going to be... Well, I'm an alcoholic, so it's probably not a good idea for me to... but I do drink Coke.
Well, okay, well, you know, you can just watch me and end up a dribbling mess in the corner then.
Yeah, well, I do take Coke and stuff, so, you know.
we'll just go and do hard drugs then. Crack.
Right. I'll speak to you soon, mate.
Right. See you later, Adam. Thanks a lot, mate.
Bye-bye. I'm not like you. I just fuck up. Come on, motherfucker. Everybody has to die. People equal shit.